Have you ever thought about the stories of the people that are writing the news? Have you ever wondered how a day in the life of a newsreader looks like? Or how much courage it takes to leave a full-time job at a national broadcaster to start a freelance journey? Do you know what motivates the journalist to get out of bed every day and go out in the world and report and write the news that you're consuming every day? Have you ever wondered what does it mean to be a non-native English speaker journalist navigating the British media industry and always feeling the pressure of being considered the other? Have you reflected on how many women, especially from those underrepresented and marginalized backgrounds that you don't actually see on the news too often, are out there paving the way for more diverse voices to enter the newsroom? If the answer to all of these questions is yes, stay with me. You are going to discover the missing narratives of women journalists, their dreams, lives, and achievements. To do that, we also need to acknowledge the fact that newsrooms are far from being truly representative of the society we live in. Luckily, we do have amazing women, trailblazers out there that are fighting and working every day to create opportunities, holding out spaces for diverse voices to enter the newsroom, and they are actually changing the face of British media. I am your host, Ilaria Biancacci, and this is Behind the Headlines, a journey through the missing narratives of women journalists, a new series of When Power podcast. Thank you very much, Luba, for being with us today, and it's an honor for me to have you as a guest on When Power podcast.
It's such a pleasure for me to be here, Ilaria. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm actually very excited about this interview, and I think we went through this on our first call, and I told you, when every time I was researching about representation and women in the news, your name kept popping up on my Google search. So at the end, I thought, well, I need to invite Luba to my podcast. And that's the reason why we are here today. And most importantly, we are here because we still think that women voices and perspective are missing from the news. And we are definitely not agree with that, right?
That's right. Okay. We don't, no.
So before we actually get into the amazing work you're doing, the research you publish, and all the achievements, you know that When Power is all about stories. So I would like to know a little bit more about your story. So who is Luba? What motivates you? What are you passionate about? So that everyone that is listening to us today can get the chance to know you a little bit better.
Oh, thank you. What a great question to start with. My background is in audience research. I've worked for a number of years for different media organizations, including heading up the audiences team for BBC Journalism. So for a big chunk of my career, I've helped journalists, including in my consultancy, to understand their audiences and deliver better journalism based on that understanding. About 4 or 5 years ago, I went through a soul-searching period, no doubt triggered by my middle age, where I realized that I just wasn't happy doing what I was doing as much as I wanted to be. And I realized through various through help that I got from a coach that I really, really wanted to write more. And in my consultancy, ACAS, I had done a lot of presentations and a lot of documents for clients, but not enough narrative writing. So this is how I decided to essentially shift my career to do more writing, non-fiction and journalism type of writing. And at that time, the Gates Foundation approached me with a project to understand women's representation in news in advance of the Gender Equality Forum that the UN was preparing for in 2020, which was a seminal, really, event. And that's how my journey through the understanding the missing perspectives of women in news started, really. And we are now 3 reports in. What I really realized I wanted to do was write, but essentially amplify the voices of those who are not heard, enough in society. About that time, or perhaps around 5 years ago, I also realized how privileged I was on many, many levels. And I went through a period of feeling guilty about it. And then I ended up realizing that actually there is a purpose to my privilege. I can use my skills and the things I've learned to actually give voice to those that don't have the opportunity to do so, whether they're women or people from ethnic minorities, children, elderly. It's different audiences that are more vulnerable and less able to express themselves. And that's what powers me now to do my writing.
This is very beautiful. Thank you for sharing. And it's obviously very aligned as well with Wempower and what we are doing in amplifying voices and stories of women like you that are making a change in their, you know, field, in their environment. We mentioned the Missing Perspective of Women in News, which were the first three reports that you published, and they were supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates mm-hmm. Foundation. But I'm also interested in the sequel of this research, which is From Outrage to Opportunity. Mm-hmm. And especially in the first part, you tackle data information related to representation, but also to leadership. So one thing that really stuck with me was that there are many, many women and girls entering the journalism field. So it's like a funnel. Mm-hmm. And on the base, we have a lot of women. And the more we go to the top, those women voices disappear. And so my question is, taking in consideration all the data that you collected and all the women and editors you talk to, how inclusive are the news? And how inclusive are the leadership cultures in the newsroom, and what we can do to actually change that?
That's a really a good question. I love the fact that you look at diversity, not just as representation, but also inclusion. And that's really, really critical, because part of the problem isn't just the fact that there are fewer women, but it's when they have a seat at the table, their voices being muted, their perspectives being dismissed. And that happens a lot in news. So to answer your question, how inclusive is the news along the whole value chain? Not very inclusive is what I found through the data analysis, but also the interviews with dozens of news editors last year that I conducted for the From Outrage to Opportunity. What I found is that leaders still, 80% of those that I interviewed admitted to the culture being dominated by men in news. And what that means is I had a very impactful interview with a news leader whom I asked how inclusive culture is. It was a woman, and other colleagues of hers who were women of color would go to their editor colleagues and offer a story, only to be dismissed and told this is actually not a story. And it's a story that's really relevant in their communities. So journalism, the culture feels exclusionary, not only at the point of leadership where there are fewer women, but also at the point of story production, where the dominant frames are those that are put forward by the overrepresented group of men, and in the global north, white men specifically.
And this is a danger for news. Because another thing that I read on your report is we do shape the news and what goes on a newspaper, on the news agenda. So if that perspective is dominated by a male vision and a white middle-class male vision, then obviously the outcome will just be representative of that part of the society. But also a very interesting point is that women and men, they consume news as well in a very different way. We are interested in different kind of news. The problem is that men are interested in the most important one for the news agenda. So you discuss this a bit as well in your report. Would you like to develop it further? Because I think it's a very interesting point.
Yeah, absolutely. To echo what you're saying, the perspectives that we put forward attract the audience similar to us, which is why we can't talk any longer about delivering news for the masses, you know, that phrase that we hear, because it isn't really for the masses. And we see that through the fact that the news industry has shrunk by 25% in the last 7 years. And if these trends continue, it will shrink in terms of revenue by another quarter in the next 10 years. And that's partly due to the fact that the news caters for, as you said, mainly men, middle-class men from certain backgrounds. And in order to deliver news that resonates with everyone, the lenses need to be expanded. And I will... I don't think I entirely agree with you in terms of men and women consuming or being interested in different topics. I think there is a myth, for example, that women are not interested in high-profile news such as politics and business. The problem is not that they're the story, but it's how it's covered. And it is the coverage of the stories that the angles that often are letting newsmakers down in terms of being relevant to women. For example, we find that women are more interested in micro angles. And I found this actually also in the Missing Perspectives of Women in COVID News, where women are interested in the same stories, but in the COVID pandemic stories, but they were more likely to be interested in the impacts on childcare, on well-being, on mental health, whereas men are more likely to be interested in micro angles. But when we did analysis of the coverage itself, we found that only 9% of the stories, online stories, and this is based on analysis of under a billion stories, if I remember correctly, only 9% contained a human interest micro angle within them. And vast majority, 75% of stories were exclusively based on facts without linking to and featuring human angles within them. So this is letting female audiences down, because connecting with a micro, with a human interest story is really important to them. And I would argue that generally audiences, regardless of their gender, are now looking more for narrative-based journalism, which doesn't only focus on the problem, but focuses on also the resolution and provides more context. This is what audiences are looking for, and journalism has a lot of catching up to do to deliver that.
Definitely. The main value as well behind WomPower is to share stories that they can make you think you want to take an action. Oh, there is a solution for that problem. Yes. It's not just a problem itself. And so maybe the gender equality in the news is not just to be achieved through leadership and through talent pool, but also in the angles that we share with our stories.
Totally.
Yeah.
And actually, one thing to add and to echo what you were saying, women are, there is a big, I just want to mention the consumption gap. There is a big consumption gap between men and women. In online news, it's 22% globally. Men are more likely, 22% more likely to consume news. And when you add print newspapers, it goes down to 15-16%. That is a very substantive consumption gap. And part of it, a big chunk of it, around 11-12%, can be closed. This is analysis that Richard Addy did, building a business case for gender equality, and found that there is an enormous opportunity to close that gap if topics are covered in a way that is relevant to women without alienating men.
Exactly. We don't want to exclude them.
No, not at all.
We need to work together to ensure, you know, that we have the right information for the right audience. If you are enjoying this conversation, make sure you follow us on all social media platforms at WomPower UK, and you subscribe to our podcast channel on Spotify and YouTube. By looking at the data you collected, also the work that Richard has done, we need to say as well, Richard is your husband and partner, and is working
and business partner,
and business partner as well. So it has worked together with you for the reports and the research. And is there any advice or any tips that you would like to share, you know, on the way that maybe a newsroom, a media company, or even if this can start at school, how we can put some action plan to start to reduce this gap? What can we do?
Yes, of course. So as you mentioned earlier, the From Outrage to Opportunity is really anchored in solutions. The whole premise of the report was not just to highlight problems that we already know, but to really zone in trying to understand how to unlock progress in two specific areas, inclusion and representation of women in leadership, and inclusion and visibility of women in news coverage. So through the interviews, I was really humbled by how many ideas already exist about how we can make progress happen. Grouped the solutions in the report into 12 themes, but underneath them there is about 100 ideas of practical things that journalists and news organizations can do to improve storytelling and to improve representation of women. One of the key suggestions that I would have for news organization is, first of all, to move away from the idea that there is a silver bullet, there is one intervention that they will, for example, the typical one is, oh, let's hire people of color who look brown and will resolve the problem, and women. That's not enough. Interventions need to be designed for each part of the news value chain, starting off with leadership, newsrooms, news gathering, news coverage, and news consumption. And only then, if we have interventions across the whole news value chain, we can be sure that some progress will be made. Another point of diversion in my own thinking from the previous reports was that I was so overwhelmed by how little progress had been made in news around the world in giving women voice that I thought, surely we need a revolutionary big sweep change. In this report, after speaking to so many editors, I realized that that's unrealistic. There is resistance to the status quo bias that we already have. And also, there is so much competition for what areas of journalism to focus on, which part of the problems. And there are so many problems around disinformation and harassment and so many issues that journalism has to deal with. So what we need to think about is small changes, little steps forward. But I realize that by making small changes along the whole news value chain, we are likely to get to a substantive shift. And also, speaking with 9 trailblazing organizations who are already making so much progress, really highlighted how they've taken small changes, but they've been consistent with trying to make a difference. They've attached targets to what they want to do, and they've seen results. Another thing that I would suggest that news organizations do is really include a goal around diversifying their journalism and their leadership teams and being more inclusive at their corporate strategy level. Because often these initiatives are seen as a nice to have, a bolt on, but they're not really taken that seriously by leadership teams. And until that happens, and there needs to be a buy-in from the top of the organization, as well as buy-in from grassroots level for change to actually happen.
And following on this, because sometimes when you go to a board, when you speak with, you know, with top executive, you need to speak about money, revenues, yeah? So right now we are missing some narratives, and therefore we are missing a part of the audience. And you say that the industry is shrinking, and in the next 10 years, we're looking at losing even more money. So if we want to put this in numbers, how much more money can a media company make if the narrative, if the news are inclusive?
That is a wonderful question that Richard would have been much better at answering, but I'll give it a shot anyhow. The analysis that he and the team did was looking at gender specifically, mm-hmm. the business case for gender equity. And I already mentioned the 11 to 12% addressable gender gap, consumption gap that could be closed once you take structural inequality out of the equation. And what Richard and the team calculated is that if the global news industry close the consumption gap by 1 percentage point a year, in the next 5 years, this would lead to an additional generation of $11 billion, and in the next 10 years, $38 billion globally, which is a substantive amount of money that the industry, which is in contraction, should take really seriously.
And again, when we talk about diversity and inclusion and gender equality specifically, he is more and more visible that if we do take action to ensure this, we actually are more profitable in every sector.
Yes, yeah. That's right. So, absolutely. I think McKinsey have done that. They do very good reports linking profitability with representation at board level, and companies that are more diverse in their board members tend to be more profitable, I understand.
Yeah, so this applies to the news as well, so please let's do something. let's take a little change every day, so maybe in less than 50 years, 20 years, I don't know, we can have a substantial change in the whole chain of the news, not just, you know, in little parts. And do not be like an exercise of like, let's tick a box. Let's, you know, we made it more diverse. We hire a little bit more women here and there. So we are achieving our diversity and inclusion goals, which is not, then it's not going to lead to any effective change.
Absolutely. Right? And actually, to build on what you're saying, I love how you speak about it in inclusive terms. We all have that responsibility. And that's a very good point. So what we found in terms of how change happens is because gender inequality is so deeply ingrained in society and the social norms that we've absorbed from the way we've been brought up, for change to happen, it needs to happen at system level, at societal level, at organizational level and individual level. And if at any point there is a pushback on any of those levels, then the whole change becomes unsustainable. Yeah. So we individually, as journalists, we have a responsibility to track our own biases, because we're all biased. I interviewed Marianne Seacart, the broadcaster mm-hmm. and journalist. And one of the things she said, which I remember feeling very thoughtful about subsequently, she said, we are so... our thinking is so biased that when we reach a representation, for example, of 35% to 40% of women, we feel that we've achieved equality.
Yeah.
So we need to be really mindful and to actually measure and be objective about this stuff. And also what speaking with Lara Joannidis from BBC 5050, BBC News 5050 project, she was saying that typically journalists are more optimistic and believe that their coverage that they're producing is more gender balanced than it typically ends up being once they start counting. So doing little interventions as individual journalists, tracking our own coverage in terms of, do we use human angles? Are we balanced in who we're speaking to in terms of gender? But also, whether when we use women as contributors, do we tend to use them as sources or witnesses or as experts? Are we more likely to mention their identity as mothers or their family status than if we spoke to a man? Or are we more likely to present them as victims rather than empowered individuals and really look at our own biases and examine whether we are indeed gender balanced? And that's a very revelatory exercise for everyone, because we always find something we need to change in our own coverage.
I'm glad you just mentioned this, because was going to be my next question. I know I didn't write it down, but for me, what is important as well as a journalist is when I reach out to a source or someone to interview for a quote for my articles, I do this exercise of checking, you know, am I giving the voice to everyone? Mm-hmm. You know, let's choose a different angle this time. So I make sure that the story is a little bit more diverse. And what you say is important, you know, the way we invite women to, comment on a fact. Are they witness? Are they victims? Are they the experts? Because most of the time, it's also this that is, you know, fighting against our fight of making news more inclusive.
Absolutely. And actually, another thing that I really want to mention is also, are we speaking to a representative of the most overrepresented group of women, who are white women, highly educated, tend to be affluent? Or are we reaching out to women from more underprivileged groups, for example, women of color, single mothers,
LGBTQ+
community. That was going to be my next, diverse sexuality. Or are we reaching out and speaking to the best represented of the marginalized community? And this is really important to try and balance out, because what I found in this report, which is the first one where we overlaid race onto gender, was that some women have it so much harder than others. The invisibility and the struggles, the challenges that women of color face in journalism is unfathomable. They have it so much harder than everyone else, and they are invisible because rarely do organizations, or in fact almost never, do they track their representation by gender and color, for example. So there is really, that this masks the problems that exist once you overlay race.
It's the intersectionality.
Exactly.
It's missing in the equation, because you're just a woman, but no, you're not. Maybe you are. You're a mother. You are, I don't know, you are black. You are from another underrepresented group, and they don't take into consideration all the, you know, all the aspects that make you that specific person. So this is very important as well to remember. And as well, one thing you make me think about when you say that sometimes we as journalists, we are the enemies of these changes. And I thought about accountability. So what you say, you know, having this practice of maybe even counting down, you know, the sources that you contact, the data that you share, the platform that you use, so that you are making yourself accountable for the change. And then if everyone is doing this, then perhaps we're going to move faster.
Absolutely.
I'm feeling like I'm going a little bit out of the question, because everything that is coming out is like really, really interesting. And I'm so passionate about this. But I mentioned this before, and how When Power is about stories that inspire an action, so positive. And yes, we highlighted some of the problems, some of the challenges, but I would like to continue on a more positive way. And I'm sure you met many editors and organizations that are already paving the way. And you mentioned somehow there are already 9 trailblazers out there doing amazing things to ensure we reach this gender equality. Would you like to tell me maybe 1 or 2 examples of like actions and programs and things that are happening and we should know about it, because they are good things?
Gosh, it's so hard to narrow them down to 1 or 2. So in the report, I have written out case studies of 9 trailblazing organizations from around the world, both from the Global South and Global North, and even from Scandinavia, a media, it's a local, the biggest local news provider in Norway, and Norway is not part of the target countries I was looking at, but they have done enormous amount of work to diversify their audience and attract more women of subscribers, and they've achieved in doing that. They shared that, first of all, they generously shared their data with us, so we were able to do analysis that shows that when you have high proportion of women who are bylines, who write the article, the proportion of women protagonists tend to be higher, and the higher the proportion of women protagonists, the higher the proportion of women readers, and then the higher the proportion of women readers, the more likely women are to subscribe to their services. So it really shows how important it is to have an intervention along the whole news value chain. But there were so many amazing other organizations, and one I would like to highlight is Kabbalaria in India. They're an all-women newsroom that focuses on reporting in rural areas, completely focusing on marginalized communities. And it was amazing. They operate in one of the most patriarchal countries in the world, where the situation actually is getting worse. They have survived, started off by doing this news paper distributed to 500 people, to then go on and have millions of subscribers in YouTube now. And they're all women, and they're doing amazing journalism. So I spoke with their editor-in-chief, and there are so many nuggets that you can get in the report. But one thing that stood out for me was how differently they approached reporting. They said there were instances when there would be perhaps a crime, big crime story in the areas that they operate, where mainstream media would come as well. And there was such a difference in how they were approaching the witnesses and the victims of that story, where news media was really after the headline. They were extremely intrusive, whereas Kabbalaria, the reporters, were absolutely adamant that they were going to look after the families. They were not breaking the news, they were not the first ones to do it, but they often got depth from the story because they were so centered around the well-being of those that they reported about. And I thought that was such a wonderful example, and that's one of many that she shared in the case study of a different approach that you can take when you... I'm not overly competing, but you're much more collaborative in how you approach journalism. I also interviewed the editor of the first gender desk in Africa, which was set up in Nation Media Group in Kenya, and it was really amazing to see the difference that, because Nation Media Group is one of the biggest providers in Kenya, actually the setup of this gender desk has reverberated and through the coverage of the country and led to increase of the proportion of stories in Kenya that talk about gender equality and gender equity issues. So they've had a really impact at a structural level to raise the visibility of voices of women and issues that are relevant to them. Of course, I also interviewed and got case studies from big providers like Bloomberg and New York Times. New York Times, for example, kicked off a really comprehensive program to improve the inclusion of women in leadership in order to deliver a more inclusive journalism. After doing a survey, which they generously released the results of, finding out that although they had reached the representation quotas in terms of people of color and women, they realized that especially people of color, they were still on the margins because they didn't feel part of that unwritten, unspoken culture that existed that helped you move to higher profile beats. And they were on the periphery of it, and therefore they felt really excluded. So New York Times is doing a very comprehensive work integrated into their values, into their corporate strategy. So it's a really interesting case studies of how to approach this really holistically. And Bloomberg, I spoke to Laura Zelenko from Bloomberg. They, for example, have increased the proportion of contributors who are women on television from 10 to 30% in 3 years, which is pretty impressive. So there are all sorts of advice and that Laura was giving, one of which was the importance of buying at a very top level. For example, in their case, I think is it weekly, but certainly at regular intervals, the editor-in-chief sends a note to say what the representation has been of women on air in that week or in a certain period. So it's very public and it's measurable. And journalists can also see how their particular area is performing against other areas, which is seen to be very, very good way of motivating journalists by tapping into their competitiveness and also by being clear what it is they're asked. Also speaking with BBC, with Lara Gionidis from BBC, she was echoing the same, the importance of having buy-in at the top and at a grassroots level, and also the importance of having methodologies, which I think you mentioned, just simple methodologies, just counting, not making them overly complex, because journalists are so incredibly busy, so time poor. They need, if they're going to be doing this, they need it to be easy and quick. I mean, I can go on and on, but...
Please do that. I know I ask you only one or two examples, but I'm getting super excited about all of this. It makes me more positive about the future of women in news. And it's not that difficult to achieve, you know, if we have so many organizations already doing that. So it's just a matter of finding a way to use this initiative in your own company and make it happen, no?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the way the report is built is it really, although it's essentially a book, it's a very big piece of work. We have packaged it in every way possible to make it easy for people just to read certain parts or just top line. It's hyperlinked throughout, so you can really get a sense of, find out what you're interested in and just read that.
We're going to put all the links at the end of this episode so people can discover a little bit more the reports and, as you say, maybe just investigate on the aspect that they are interested in.
Absolutely.
So we talk about tips and advice for the general, you know, the executives, the media company. But would you like to share any advice with any younger journalist, woman journalist out there?
Oh, I would love that. And actually, you send me this question in advance. I was really thinking about it because it's such an important question. And I really wanted to answer it in a way that is thoughtful and in a way almost providing the advice that I would have liked if I was starting out as a journalist. So I have thought a few things that I'd like to share. First of all, I think there is an incredible book by Marianne Seacott that I mentioned, the journalist and broadcaster, called The Authority Gap, which was released. Oh, it's here. That's Look. Wonderful. So this book is, I think, essential reading for any woman, young woman, but also particularly a woman in journalism, because it will really help everyone understand what's the starting point and to what extent the barriers that female journalists face can be explained through their own doing and to what extent they have to be explained through the structural disadvantages that they're facing in terms of not being taken as seriously, being dismissed and so on and so forth. So this book is absolutely fantastic. And it's also really great because it has number of recommendations at the end and tips of what to do. So that would be my first advice. So my second advice is for women journalists to really check out the plethora of programs available to journalists out there, for example, from the International Center for Journalists on their IJNet, really regularly publishes different opportunities that are available for journalists globally. And I would really encourage young female journalists to try those. Also, something I have written about is the importance to be able to marry narratives as a journalist with numbers. And often journalists have aversion to maths and to numbers. And I want to reassure those who do that actually you don't need to be very sophisticated mathematician to be able to look at trends, for example, the difference in men and women on number of things such as the gender gap or health gap. It's not complex maths, but to be able to marry the perspectives through interviews and narratives with what's actually happening structurally is where I think journalism is heading. This is the future of journalism. So steeping yourself in the ability to look at data, as I said, it's not that difficult. What could get you a long way is really beneficial, I think, would be very beneficial for journalists. And I think another advice I have is to link whatever efforts women journalists have with their purpose. Make sure that they write about things they feel passionate about, because this will help them really excel at their craft and get that edge that they so deserve. And really, my final piece of advice is don't be afraid to occupy the space that you're occupying, because you have, although the longer you stay in journalism, the more of a minority you will become. You have the right to be there and your perspectives are unique. And I hope we get to a point where the stories that women bring from different communities will be seen as a bonus in journalism rather than being dismissed as non-stories, which is what often happens now.
Very beautiful advices. Thank you very much for sharing this and following this very positive note to conclude this interview. What are you most hopeful for the future of women in journalism?
I am very hopeful that women will increasingly not just have seat at the table, but also their perspectives will be validated and used as leverage, and they will essentially make journalism better through the story angles that they bring, through the way they tell stories, through the contextual information that they bring to different stories, and through being able to extract unique perspectives and human angles from various stories. I have very high hopes for journalism once women and men work in true partnership and learn from one another and just take journalism that step forward to its next level.
I have nothing else to add to this. Thank you very much, Luba. This was a super, super interesting conversation. And I hope to see you again on When Power Podcast in the future.
Oh, I would love to come again. And I really want to support your effort. because I think it's the work you do is so important and fills a gap in storytelling, as we've discussed. And it's really important that we support us. Actually, something else to mention is allyship came out as a very important thing. Allyship, for women to women, but also men supporting women, and generally allyship to help unlock the career of women and storytelling is so, so important. So I really want to be an ally, and I would love to come back. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.